We were just talking about the fact that I was going to boycott that damn 71B yeast. I don't know, Chris. You know, for the life of me, I can't figure out why it, you know, out of all the yeast that I use around here, 71B is the one that gives me all the fits.
You got to treat them like a pet.
I guess.
You're not talking sweet to them.
Yeah, you know, we had that problem with the sourwood, as you recall. And, you know, I had to beat that into submission with some 1118. It finally took off and, you know, started doing its thing. You know, I mean, and it did okay. So, I mean, I dumped some 1118 in this little... This is a little one-gallon traditional thing. This is all Ryan's fault. This is one of Ryan's recipes. Actually,
when you put your yeast in, did you put it in with your left hand or your right hand?
Yeah. Is it coming down to that now?
Yeah. Well, it's got to be something.
You know, it's just a tad over a pound of honey, you know, whatever it was to make it come out to like, you know, 1.050. This is going to be one of them Ryan special low alcohol session type deals, and you know, right now it's sitting at like 3%. I'm trying to get it. Come on, give me 5% at least, you know. Give me something so I can feel something after a couple of glasses, you know, but we're not even there yet. So, but, I don't know, 71B, I don't know what it is, man. But we'll coax it along and see what happens. So, man, unless anybody's got any suggestions, I just have no idea. Maybe we'll talk about it later on during the show. Anyway, hey, welcome to the Mead House. I want to remind everybody out there that's going to listen to this thing now, and those of you that will listen a little bit later on, this is our last show. We will be on hiatus until February 28th. We'll be back on the 28th, so off for a couple of weeks here in February. Kind of kick back and enjoy some time off. I'm sure a bunch of us here sitting around the table probably got a few projects we need to tend to, look after, and clean up maybe. But hey, the replay always available on iTunes, Stitcher, themeadhouse.com, right here where we live. You can listen live, get the app, and take us with you if you want. TuneIn Radio is where you get that. We're also live on TuneIn Radio. Just search for the Mead House. It'll pop right up. Call in number if you want to give us a holler, 818-921-4680. Now, we've been having some issues with the phone calls. I tested it before we went live tonight. It should work. If it doesn't, we'll figure out somehow to get you on the show. But anyway, Ryan Richardson in the house tonight. Aaron Martin back from his illness. Mississippi Chris Spencer along for the ride. Jeff Schaus, what's going on Facebook, bud?
So I got a couple posts today. one was from Conrad Wheeler on Mead Makers. It was brewing up a gingerbread mead as opposed to just ginger. Had a really interesting flavor profile here. He's using... In addition to ginger, he's got some vanilla, some cinnamon, nutmeg, and molasses. Looked to be a really interesting brew up there. And he posted the recipe along with the pictures. So you can go and check that out. Then it looks like Jeff King, also on Mead Makers, had a really busy day yesterday. Says he kegged up a mead from 2014. He's got a blueberry blossom mead and a cranberry mead made with cranberry blossom honey that he's put together. There's a three-gallon batch of some urban honey that he put into growlers, and then had a pilot batch of some an Acer Glen, the mead made with maple syrup that he's put on some bourbon-soaked chips, and then has a really old sack mead that he's adding some fennel, star anise, and wormwood to make an absinthe style mead with. So lots of different flavor profiles going on there. Really interesting, really busy day. So good for you, Jeff.
Yeah, no kidding. Man, I'd like to hear more about that maple deal with the bourbon. Did you say?
Yeah, bourbon soaked oak chips. Maple syrup and bourbon sound like they would go real nice together. I agree.
Yeah, you know, I've heard of people even taking their maple syrup and dropping these bourbon soaked chips into it and just pancakes and whatever else, barbecue sauces and whatnot. So it sounds good. Anything else?
Oh, that's all I had for this week.
Cool. Well, looking forward to catching up with him maybe in a couple of weeks, find out where he's at with these projects. They really sound good. I'm intrigued by that gingerbread thing. I was kind of curious, we've always heard about the ginger meads, but how do you get the gingerbread part? When I heard molasses and some of the other ingredients, I can see where that's going to come together, and looking forward to hearing his tasting notes when that one gets all finished. But
line and let them know to keep us updated there.
Yeah. In fact, send him an invite. Let's get him on the show and talk about what he's got going on there. I mean, those are some flavor profiles that kind of far and few between. You don't really run across those kind of things, you know?
Oh, definitely.
What are we drinking tonight? I'm going to start this one off. I got this beer, and you've probably seen, I put the picture on my Facebook a couple times. This is from Dog Tag Brewery. And if you've never heard of it, I found these guys. I was watching Fox and Friends one morning, news show, and they had the guy that owns this brewery on the show. And this is a brewery that they brew this Dog Tag beer. It's called Legacy Lager. And the proceeds from the sales of this particular beer they brew goes directly to the veterans of the United States military. Now, on each can, okay, they have a dog tag, a little silver dog tag on it, and it has the name of a military veteran. Tonight, I'm drinking to, if I can read this thing, I'm drinking to Corporal Sean P. Hefner out of Hyco, Texas. He's a United States Marine with the 20th AAV. I can't hardly read all this stuff. I can't read the rest of it, but anyway, this is a pretty cool thing. Now, the beer it's okay for a lager, kind of on the Budweiser line. Kind of hate to say that, but not a huge fan. But I didn't buy it for the beer. I bought it because the money I spent on it was going directly to the veterans. So, Dog Tag Brewery. If you guys can, if you get it out there where you're at, where you live, I would encourage you guys to go out and buy a couple of four. They come in four packs. Buy a couple of them, and it's a good way to support our veterans. So anyway, Aaron, welcome back, my friend.
Thank you. Good to be back. Nothing too exciting in the glass tonight. I am feeling much better. Not quite to 100%, so I'm drinking Gatorade tonight. it's been about like 2.5 or 3 weeks since I've had a beer or a glass of mead, so hopefully this weekend I'll be able
to crack some open. Put some vodka in it. Put some tequila in it.
You know, I was thinking maybe a little whiskey or something. That might be just what the doctor ordered.
Well, when I was a kid, my grandmother used to cook me up a little cup of tea with whiskey, lemon, and honey in it. And It tasted good, and I think the whole idea behind it was to just put you to sleep.
Yep.
Anyway, Jeff, what's in your glass tonight? Is Jeff here? Or did we lose Jeff? Unmute yourself, Jeff.
Sorry, I had to get back to the show to unmute the line. I'm still on a Belgian Golden kick. So tonight I got a big tall bottle of Duvel in front of me. It's a very light, you know, Pilsner style malt beer, but a lot of, you know, body, kind of characteristic of a Belgian, a lot of carbonation with almost like a champagne style, carbonation bite to it. Really bright and refreshing, but has a lot of body and a lot of like that kind of fruity, Belgian ale kick to it too. So it's a really nice combination.
Yeah. Sounds good. Mississippi. I know you had a long day today.
I did. I really had a long day. I'm speaking of different flavor profiles. I'm actually sitting here drinking a cup of, Earl Grey tea. And as I'm drinking it, I mean, it's probably my favorite hot tea to drink. And I'm just sitting here trying to think, what could I pair this with in a mead? How can I turn this into a mead? And I know there's a flavor combination there somewhere, but so far I've drawn a blank as to what I could put with this bergamot flavor. I don't know. This is definitely my favorite tea. And, you know, the thought crossed my mind that maybe I could do a traditional with some brewed Earl Grey, but I don't know. There's something in my mind that seems like those flavors would clash. So,
you know, one of the best teas that I ever had was an Earl Grey with a little bit of bitter orange peel in it.
There you go. Just going to say.
Yeah. Maybe that's something people, if you've got any ideas out there, email. You know, if you've run across something in the past that just goes perfect with that Earl Grey flavor, send us a message and give us some ideas.
Well, funny you two should mention that, because what I was going to say this morning, okay, we had to make a run over to my wife's dad's place and do an errand for him and come back. We were back here at the house by 9 a.m. this morning, so I've got all kinds of English teas here, and I love the Earl Grey as well. And I fixed myself a cup of Earl Grey with some of my wildflower honey, and I got into the fruit drawer in the refrigerator and picked out an orange and carved off a couple of good healthy pieces of orange rind, orange peel, and dropped into my hot tea. And that is really good. The sweetness obviously comes from the honey, but you definitely get that orange flavor coming off of those orange peels. I want to look into. Next time you fix yourself a cup of hot tea, Chris, drop an orange peel in it. Sometimes I'll even drop a lemon peel in, but drop an orange peel in and see what you think.
I'll do it.
Ryan, what are you doing tonight?
I'm drinking the Sizer from Groenfell that Ricky sent us.
And
it's, you know, it's, I'm not getting a lot of apple out of it. It's good, but, you know, I know it's only 20% apple juice in this. I'm just getting that faintest hint of apple, and I'm not really picking up the vanilla yet, but I know that, some of his stuff in the past, when it's cold, tends to hide some of the flavors that come out as it warms a little bit and comes a little closer to room temperature. So I'll check in with you, you know, before we sign off and let you know how it's doing, if some of that comes back.
Yeah, you know,
Ryan, I didn't get a lot of apple out of that either. And, you know, this is just an observation, and it may not hold true for everyone, but I have made things with apples and apple juice, everything from this graft project to lighter styles like you're drinking to full-on ciders and sizers and everything. And I've come to the conclusion that anything that's brewed or fermented with apples or apple juice has to have some time. It takes a while for some reason for the apple flavor to come back. And everything I've ever made with apples, that's been true. So I just wonder if it's, you know, because it's young.
Yeah, it's also, again, it's 20% apple juice. You know, in a 5-gallon batch of this stuff, he only uses 1 gallon of apple juice. You know, the sizers and ciders and that I make, I let sit. I try to let age for at least a year. Sometimes they don't get past 6 months. But exactly what you're saying, Chris, I mean, it gets a lot better with a little bit of age on it.
Yeah. I don't know what does that, but I can get everything that I make into a bottle. Usually within a couple of months, I can have it ready in a bottle to drink. But for some reason, when I make something with apple, you know, it's going to sit in the carboy for a year before I bottle it.
I wonder if it has something to do with the apples themselves, you know, the type of apples that they use to make the juice out of. I mean, obviously they're not cider apples. I'm talking out the side of my mouth. I don't even know what impact the cider apples have other than they make damn good hard cider. But, as far as the aging time, I don't know if cider apples have a quicker, barrel to bottle time or not. So,
I don't know.
Might be interesting to see if we can dig around and find that out. I was going to get back to Ryan on this, grown, they're low alcohol types, you know, stuff that you had talked about, before, Ryan, and I'm wondering if this 20% apple juice, I mean, what do you suppose would happen if you put more? I mean, I wonder what the
I've never made something with a cider or an apple wine or anything like that with such a low volume of it being apple juice.
Like you do that cherry thing, wasn't it cherry or what was it? You said you only used a cup of juice.
Yeah, that was that. Yeah. Yeah. I've done that with the cherry where I used, I made a gallon of traditional and then I stabilized it. And then on top of that, put in, what was it, 4 ounces of tart cherry juice? Yeah. Now, I mean, tart cherry juice, I mean, you go to the grocery store, they're selling tart cherry juice in quart jars, you know, and you're selling apple juice in the gallon jars. I mean, it's quite a bit more potent than the apple juice. So, I mean, to me, that's a function of it being the strength of that juice that you're getting.
Yeah. Well, I think Chris is on something. I think there's something about apples and apple juice. It just takes a long time, for that flavor to come around. I've got a couple of ciders sitting in 5-gallon carboys here that are probably about, at least 3 months old. And I don't intend on touching them for at least another 6 months. So, we'll just wait and see.
Yeah. I put that blueberry sizer together back when we posted it on the website, and that was what, like October maybe?
Yeah.
When we did that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that thing's been sitting in secondary now, and, it's still nowhere even close.
Yeah.
It's going to need, we're looking at probably October before it's ready. So
yeah,
they just take a while.
I got this little gizmo. I saw this YouTube video. I don't know if you guys have seen this thing or not, but it's called a carbonator cap. And it looks like the top of a keg where you put the CO2 connection, like a ball, a ball lock connection. And then, it's, brazed on or welded on to this nut, that fits the top of these, what are they? 1 liter, 2 liter Pepsi plastic PET bottle. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can, I played around with one today, and it works pretty darn good, I tell you. And I thought, man, this is the way to carbonate these little 1 gallon projects. And this is why I was so anxious for this Ryan project to finish up with the 71B. Because I went to a store and I bought 2 things of Sunkist Orange. Well, those got dumped down the sink because I don't drink soda. I just wanted the Pepsi containers or the plastic container. So for 99 cents, I figured, you know what? I'll treat my drain to a nice orange soda. But you screw this, you put your liquid in. Now you got to leave some air space at the top, like maybe 4 inches or so. And you put your liquid in, put the top on, squeeze the bottle so you squeeze that air out, and then hook up your CO2. Now, I thought, you know, when I first was looking at this, doing this, I thought, you know, maybe, you know, like 4 pounds. No, you want to crank that baby up to like 30 pounds. And I thought, man, my wife's going to be so pissed because this thing's going to explode. Well, it doesn't. I mean, you can get 30 pounds of pressure in those PET bottles, nothing to it. But you carb it up, disconnect it, shake the crap out of it, and the bottle will go soft. And when it's pretty much done, it'll stay hard. So it maybe 2 or 3 times. To carbonate the liquid. So I thought, man, that's the way to go. So, that's what I was going to do to this, that's how I'm going to carb this, if I can get it going, this Ryan project I got going. So I don't know if you guys have ever seen those things yet or not.
Where'd you get it?
Off of Amazon.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just a carbonator. It's a stainless steel. They make plastic ones. Don't get the plastic ones. Get the stainless steel one. I'll put a link up on the webpage later on. But I got it off of Amazon. It's made of stainless steel. And the top, like I say, it looks just like a ball cock or a ball connection to a keg. And you just screw this thing onto your soda bottle. And connect your CO2 and carbonate whatever you want, anything. I mean, you can take orange juice and carbonate the crap out of it, I guess, if you wanted to do that. So, but I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely sounds like a neat toy to me, too. And I agree, a good way to do those 1 gallon batches. Carve those up nice and easy.
Do you have to leave the little cap on until you drink it all, and then?
No. It's just like a soda. Once it's carbonated, you take that cap off of there and put the regular cap back on it, and put it in the refrigerator.
So you could? Can you use it on like the little 20-ounce PET bottles?
I don't know. Well, as long as the cap fits.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
Technically, if you wanted to go through the trouble, if you didn't have a beer gun, you could just carb up some 20-ounce PETs to send to your friends.
Well, okay, so the one I have has a little gizmo on the bottom that sticks down. You can attach a piece of tubing to. And there's one guy that I saw, he instead of taking the whole keg to the neighbor's house, if you're going to have dinner and there's just four of you, he puts a little tube on the bottom of this thing, screws it onto his bottle, squeezes all the air out of it, and then hooks it up to the liquid side, okay, of his keg. And he fills these 2-liter bottles full of beer. It's already carbonated. And that's pretty cool, too. So, if you wanted to just take a 2-liter, Pepsi container of beer to the neighbor's house for ball game or whatever, I thought that was a pretty cool way to do it. So it'll carbonate, plus you can use it to fill as well, if you got the right kind of. Now, you have to make up your own filler because, remember, it takes the CO2 connection. So you'll have to make up your own little pigtail line to go from the keg to the bottle, okay? Because one side's going to have the liquid out connector, and the other end's going to have the CO2 connector, which goes on your bottle. So I thought that was pretty cool. But anyway, hey, the last show, guys, we started getting into this piment thing. And Ryan did a pretty good job of kind of explaining to us what that was all about. I think we talked about, different juices, wine juices. I think Ryan did a fantastic job, describing. Really, Ryan, wasn't there four? Because you included the frozen grape juice that you find in the store. Concord grape juice, and then of course the three different kinds of grape juice that you can get from your local brew shop through these wine kits type of thing, and then of course if you can get somewhere where you can get the actual juice, the real deal, that too. But this week you're going to come up with a pretty simple recipe that we could throw together. What'd you come up with?
Yeah, no, I did. And just to go back and to talk about wine for a minute, I think would be really helpful. When you go to the store or the market or restaurant, or you're at home and you open a bottle of Cabernet, or you open a bottle that says Pinot on it, a lot of people don't know what that means. And in the U.S. and maybe internationally, but at least in the U.S., the varietal that's listed on the bottle only has to make up 75% of the grapes that are in that bottle. So, for example, Cabernet Sauvignon, that is a grape. You can go buy a Cabernet Sauvignon grape. But if you buy a bottle of Cabernet Sauvignon wine, that technically only has to be 75% Cabernet grapes, and it could be 25%, any other kind of grape. Now, typically, it's not that widespread. It might be 98% Cabernet grapes and 2% Pinotage or Merlot or something like that. These good wines, and most good wines are a blend of some sort. They might be 1%, 2%, 3%, but they're typically a blend. The most famous blend is probably Bordeaux. You can't go to the market and say, hey, I want to buy Bordeaux grapes. There's no such thing as a Bordeaux varietal.
Right.
Bordeaux is a region in France, and several types of grapes grow there. And Bordeaux wine is a blend of the different grapes that grow there. All the chateaus and the vineyards, you know, grow their own kind of grapes. So with that being said, a little bit of wine knowledge for our audience there, but leading into where I'm going with this is that, don't be afraid of doing a little bit of your own blending. You know, and taking two wines that might play well together or that are close, and blending them. Some of the best wines out there are blends, you know, and they'll say on the bottle, red blend or white blend. And that's because no one grape makes up at least 75% of the contents. I'm thinking of Quintessa. You know, Quintessa is a, you know, $150, $200 bottle of wine at the liquor store, and it's not a varietal. It is just a master blend of good grapes. So, you know, you'll see different types of juice play well together, different types of wines play together, and you can do that. So now getting into this very simple piment recipe, and maybe I'll call it a formula. You know, maybe we'll, that might be a better term, because I do want you to play with it. I want you to make it your own, and I want you to do this to your own taste. JD said something inadvertently maybe it was intentional, maybe it was inadvertently at the last show, and he said, put together a 3-gallon recipe for us.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not always common. You know, if you make beer, you typically have 5-gallon carboys and maybe some 1-gallon carboys. If you make wine, you might have 6 or 6.5-gallon carboys, maybe some 1-gallon carboys. But 3 is not the most common number. I mean, 3-gallon carboys are not hard to find. Every homebrew supply shop has them, but they're not always utilized. And, you know, JD there's a gold nugget in what he said there. And the 3-gallon carboy is probably the most underutilized size that there is. And, you know, if you've got the means, if you can afford it, I highly recommend that you pick up a couple of 3-gallon carboys. They are, you know, not every recipe you can make as small as 1 gallon. There's just some things that don't scale all the way down to 1 gallon. And some things you don't want to make 5 or 6 gallons of when you're the first time you make it. You know, you want to test it out, or maybe the ingredients are just too pricey, and you know, you want to make damn sure you're going to enjoy it before you invest 5 gallons worth. So that 3-gallon carboy is, I've got 2 of them and they're always full. And you know, hell, I wouldn't mind picking up a couple more. So with that being said, you know, like I said, if you can afford it, if you've got the means, go out and get yourself a couple of 3-gallon carboys. I'm going to walk you through a 3-gallon formula here on a piment. And we did talk about a couple of the different ways that you can get wine juice or grape juice for wine. We talked about the wine kits. We talked about during the harvest, when a lot of homebrew supply shops get fresh juice in. We talked about the supermarket juices, you know, whether fresh or concentrate. And then we talked about the canned juices, which it's from the homebrew supply shop. Alexander's being probably the most common, the most famous. So that's what we're going to do here. We're going to do. And
we're losing Ryan again. Go, Ryan.
You're doing that thing, Ryan.
Yeah, he just dropped out. Let me see if I can get him back here.
We didn't want to hear the damn recipe anyway.
I don't know. You know, Aaron once in a while has an issue, but now it's Ryan's turn again. Ryan, you back? Oh, still not there yet.
He's probably still talking about his recipe.
Yeah, I try them again here. Ryan's right. I mean, these 3 gallon carboys, as far as I'm concerned, are priceless. I've got three of them.
The first the first carboy I ever bought was a 3 gallon, and I've since learned. You know, we talk about splitting up a batch, and it's perfect to have a couple, and to have a like a 6 gallon carboy, and you can split it in half.
Yeah,
and add something to one and something to the other, and yeah, it's a good thing to have.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I think we got Ryan back.
I don't know what happened there.
I don't either. Gremlins, dude. I mean, they're all over the place.
It went real quiet when I said 2 cans of Alexander's. Is that where you guys lost me?
Well, yeah, kind of before that. You just started going through the recipe. So start from the top of the recipe.
Okay, so what you're going to want here for your 3-gallon recipe is you're going to want 2 cans of the Alexander's concentrate. You know, the cans are 46 ounces. They come in at 68 bricks. You know, I don't have the conversion in front of me, so I don't know what that is in SGF top of my head. But, you know, you're going to get 2 cans. Like I was saying before, feel free to blend 2 different varieties. Really try to, you know, make it a wine that you enjoy, a wine that you like. For purposes of walking you through this, I'm going to say Riesling. I'm going to say get the 2 cans of the Riesling, and we're going to make a Riesling, you know, piment here. To that 2 cans of Alexander's, you know, you're going to, same protocol as you do with anything else. You know, you open the can. First of all, dunk the cans in sanitizer. Dunk those cans in sanitizer because you're going to use a can opener to open them. And, you know, you might pour a little bit on the edge. So
sanitize the can opener too, right?
Sanitize, of course. Yeah. Sanitize the can opener, sanitize the cans. Pour those into your fermenter, whatever you're using is your fermenter. And then, you know, I always fill those cans up with water and swirl them around, you know, and, make sure you get all that good concentrate out of them. And then to that, you're also going to add 3 pounds of honey. Now for this Riesling, you don't want the honey to overpower this lighter, wine that we're going to make. And I'm specifically make a dry Riesling. A couple of varieties that I think might work well would be if you've got a nice light clover, an orange blossom, or an alfalfa. You know, and if we're blending grape juice here, there's no reason you can't blend the honeys either. You know, if you use, you know, you don't have to stick with one, but I wouldn't go to anything too dark and I wouldn't go to anything too potent. You know, I'd try to stay on the lighter end here. And then you're gonna bring that up to a little over 3 gallons. You know, I go a little bit over knowing that you're gonna get a lot of sediment on the bottom, or right around 3 gallons is fine too. That's gonna bring you to just a smidge over 1.1 on the gravity. Your specific gravity is probably gonna be somewhere 1.106, 1.10. You know, depending on the honey you use, and exact, you know, it could go a little bit above that. You might go all the way up to, you know, 11. It could be 1110. It might be as low as 1105, but you're going to be in that neighborhood. JD, you know, sorry, but I wrote this recipe down using 71B. And I specifically use 71B because it ages fast. You know, that's one thing this yeast does well. So 71B, 1122, use the whole sachet. Whatever your protocol is for rehydration, I recommend doing that. So if you use GoFirm, if you use a Nutrifirm, whatever you've had success with, you know, use your typical rehydration protocol. Now, I personally use, for my nutrient additions, I've been sticking with Fermato only. I don't use DAP. I haven't used Firm 8K. You know, it's, I've just been sticking. I haven't done the Y Yeast, you know, winemaker's blend. If you've had success with those, again, do what you do. If for this recipe, Fermato, I've got it calculated out to 3.5 grams per dose, and we're going to do 4 doses. So you're going to do 3.5 grams of Fermato at pitch, and then you're going to do a 24-hour, 48-hour, and 72-hour addition. However, you know, that last addition always has a an asterisk on it, because if you've gotten you know, too much of the sugar consumed, that Fermate O isn't going to be necessary, and might actually leave you an off flavor if you're adding it after. A lot of, I know the standard is 1/3. I actually go a little bit above that. You know, if it's more like, if you're doing your calculations, I don't go all the way down to 1/3. I might stop at, you know, 0.3, you know, something around there, and back off a little bit. But those are the 4 additions. With each addition, you're going to, degas or aerate. You know, you're going to, you know, hit it with your wine whip, if you've got a wine whip. And when it gets down to around 10-10, when it gets to about 10-10, you're going to want to rack it into your 3-gallon carboy, and let it hang out there. Then in another, and that's tough to say how long it could take. It could take 5 days. It could take 7 days. You know, I mean, you keep an eye on it. Another couple weeks go by. If we're lucky and our fingers are crossed and we didn't get, that 71B out of JD's drawer, it should drop below 1. And when it drops below 1, I'd rack it again into your second 3-gallon carboy. Cause I said to get 2 of them, right? I said get a couple of them. You know, so when it drops below that rack, you know, drops below 1, rack it again into your second 3-gallon carboy, put the airlock on it. And I'd put a sign on it that says, you know, check me in 6 months. And that's when you should be hitting, you should be getting really amazing flavor out of it at about 6 months. At about 6 months, that honey flavor should have come back a little bit as well. And you'd be surprised, even though the gravity on this is going to say that it's completely dry. And you know, I've seen different levels, gravity levels for what constitutes a dry wine and a off dry and a semi-sweet and a sweet and that kind of thing. But typically it's, you know, if maybe 10-10, 10-20, you know, somewhere in there. I mean, if you're definitely below 1, I mean, obviously you're bone dry. But you're going to have some perceived sweetness with that honey. Now, if you still don't like it, if you say, hey, this is too dry for me, I'd stabilize the wine. And then you've got some options. And now that let's just call this the end of the formula, you know, which is I've waited 6 months and I'm tasting it. Now I'll kind of break off from the formula a little bit and I'll say what your options are if you want to back sweeten it. If you want to back sweeten it, you've a lot of winemakers, home winemakers, I will say, especially when they're making fruit wines, back sweeten with sugar. They'll add white sugar, you know, white cane sugar to it. You know, they'll back sweeten that way, and they will wait it out, and that sugar will kind of work its way into that wine pretty well, and actually help bring out some of that fruit flavor. You know, I mean, a little. you put a little bit of sugar on your strawberry.
You're talking about using like regular old white cane sugar and just putting that right in the carboy.
Yeah, you know, you look up a recipe for dragon's blood, or look up a recipe for skeeter pea. These are two very common fruit line home recipes, and yeah, they just take white table sugar and they dump it into their finished stabilized wine.
So you wouldn't make a simple syrup, like a 2-to-1 typical simple syrup, 2 cups sugar, 1 cup water, that kind of thing, and pour that in. You're going to go ahead and let the wine dissolve the sugar, then, I take.
That's what these guys do. These guys do. I say there's nothing wrong with that if you like it. You know, I mean, a lot of people I know will take a bowl of fresh strawberries and they'll put a sprinkle of sugar on it because it helps bring out the flavor of the fruit. Now, that's not the way I would do it. I'm just telling you what your options are here. You could also do something similar with honey. You could, instead of adding raw sugar, you could add a little raw honey. Again, that's not necessarily something I would do. The two things that I would do with this would be, number one, I often mention, if you've got the time, the space, the inclination, that kind of thing, I make batches of traditional that are either sweet or dry, and the purpose of them is to blend when I need to blend some wine, blend some meat or wine or whatever it is to get it there. I prefer blending to get that flavor over just dumping in sugar. Now, again, now we got a couple of issues, because first of all, you got to make these 1 gallon batches. Then you got to figure out another formula on how much to add. And then there's even that last, and then you got to figure, okay, well, I got to be ready to bottle this now, because if it's 3 gallons that I'm doing and I added a 1/2 gallon of sweet mead that I made, now I've got 3.5 gallons and there's no such thing as a 3.5 gallon carboy. So I probably got to blend that in my bottling bucket so that I can bottle right from there. Mm-hmm. That's not the worst situation in the world. The fourth option I'll give everybody, and this one gets a little more out there, is that I know cider makers who when they make a cider, they take their cider all the way dry. They take it all the way down, to nothing, and then they stabilize it, and then they add a can of concentrated apple juice.
Right.
And they back sweeten with concentrated apple juice.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
What you can do in this case is, if you want to make more of an Arbor Mist, style wine, is you could stabilize it and then.
Ryan, you dropped out again, son.
You hear me?
Yeah, there you are. Okay, yeah, you're back. Go ahead.
Okay. So in that same way of the cider makers who back sweeten with the concentrated apple juice, if you want to make more of an Arbor Mist, style wine, you could back sweeten this with, concentrated cherry juice or concentrated mango juice or concentrated pineapple, some sort of fruit, juice to it. And then you'd have this kind of Arbor Mist style wine that's got a little bit of fresh fruit kick to it. And that's how you do it. Now, like I said, I stopped with the formula about 10 minutes ago, but I'm giving you a few options here on how to finish it off on what you might want to do with it.
Cool. I was going to ask you about, what kind of adjuncts that you might consider, oaking or anything like that. But, what the hell? Might as well. Once you get it to a certain point, we're going to be looking at this thing in the carboy for, 6 months, like you said. What kind of adjuncts are you looking at coming out of the fermenter? You racked it into the carboy. add some oak. What do you think?
Well, you know, if your goal is to make a blend between wine and mead, then what I would do is I would try to stay true to the style of wine. Mm-hmm. So Rieslings are typically not oaked. So right. I'm not going to add any oak to it. If I were having a nice Cabernet, I mean, or even a Chardonnay, you know, Chardonnays were typically oaked until this guy realized, hey, I can call it unoaked and save money from having to put it in barrels. but you know, Chardonnays are typically oaked, you know, Cabernets are oaked, things like that. You can add some oak to it that I absolutely think would be true to style. Now, if you were sitting there for 6 months and you said, you know, I think a stick of ginger and a snip of vanilla and, you know, a little bit of, you know, something else might be good in there. Go ahead. You know, again, that's up to you. That's completely up to you and more power to you. It's a blank canvas. Just decide what you want to do when you start out. Do you want to make something that's a blend between a wine and a mead? Or do you really want to look at this as the mad scientist and create something that you might be the only person who's ever thought of or try? That's up to you. There's a brewer that has made a lot of great stuff. You're a professional brewer. One of his quotes is this guy is constantly celebrated, but he wins very few awards at brewer competitions. And he said, I don't win awards because I don't brew to style. You gotta, you know, when you go to a competition, you gotta be the best example of a style. I don't brew to style. I brew to taste.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the thing here is do whatever is going to make your taste buds happy, or more importantly, your wife's taste buds happy. And, and go from there.
Yeah, I didn't raise award-winning beef, but I had some of those damn good that came off my ranch. So, fed with my own grass. good stuff, Ryan. I love it. I'm not a Riesling drinker, but this sounds intriguing. This is something that, I think I've got an empty 3 gallon carboy sitting here. Plus, I've got an empty fermenter that's been begging me to throw something in it. So perhaps over
Ryan,
the 2 weeks, I might order me that Riesling. Go ahead, Chris.
Oh, Ryan mentioned something about the blending at the end there, and I needed to touch on this really quickly. I got an email from a guy that's been listening to us for a while. His name is Joseph. And, he was asking me a question. He said, what if I wanted to make, a mead that had some residual sweetness, but I only wanted to make it, like, you know, 10% or 12% ABV, but you know, most of your wine yeast start at 14%, like a 71B or something. And he was basically saying, you know, I don't want to go through stabilizing it. When you add potassium sorbate, you automatically put a limit. You put a shelf life on it, so to speak. Eventually, that potassium sorbate is going to break down into some undesirable flavors. Mm-hmm. So you're putting a definite shelf life on your mead when you do that. So he was asking, how can I make this lower ABV sweet mead with a higher ABV yeast? So I was going to take a second and answer this, and this is how I would do it. You're going to make two batches, and you're just going to take your average. So let's just start out with the gravity, for instance. Let's say that you want to end up with 10-20 as your final gravity. So what you want to do is you want to ferment one batch completely dry, and you want to ferment the other batch so that it stops at 1040. And when you blend those two in equal parts, you're going to have a 1020 gravity. So that's how you would get your gravity. And then as far as your alcohol level, your ABV, you do the same exact thing. So you know that your sweetest one, the one that's 1040, you know that's going to be 14%. And you're wanting to get to, let's say, 12%. So what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to engineer your dry batch so that it's going to end up at, you know, the average, the addition of the two is 24% ABV, which would be your dry one would be 10%. So you're blending in equal parts, a 10% and a 14%. And when you blend them in equal parts, it's going to give you a 12% ABV. So that's how you do it. Just do the math and find the average. So that's how you would do that without stabilizing chemicals.
I didn't know.
Although, let me say this. When you do that, you're really going to need to sulfite those meads heavily, because if you don't, they are going to referment. So you're going to have to let those individual batches sit until they're crystal clear and sulfite both of them heavily when you blend them. And there's still no guarantee that that's not going to kick off in the future, but chances are they won't. So just be aware of that.
I didn't realize that the sorbates had that shelf life. What kind of time frame are you looking at here? Years?
Well, I've had some that I put sorbate in long, long time ago. And within a year and a half, you can start to taste those that sorbate breaking down. Yeah. Now, I've read in several different places that it happens much faster than that, but I do know that a sorbated mead is good for a year, for sure. It's not terrible at a year and a half, but I can usually start to taste it at a year and a half.
Yeah.
So I will say this, though. A lot of people don't realize that sorbate is dependent greatly on the total acidity of the mead or wine, and it's also dependent on the free SO2 levels. So if you have, let's say you made a raspberry melomel, well, that's a really highly acidic mead. So you're not going to need as much SO2, and you're not going to need nearly as much sorbate. This idea, you know, I think on the bottle it says a half teaspoon per gallon of sorbate. Very seldom do you ever really need that much. And I'll give you an example. I actually did the math on one that I did a while back. And at 14% ABV with the proper, I think it was 40 parts per million SO2, I only needed 0.24 grams per gallon of sorbate. So we're talking about I ended up putting less than half a teaspoon for a full 5 gallon batch. So that greatly reduces the flavors that if you can do the math, if you'll look up a chart and find, and if you actually test your total acidity like winemakers do, you can get by with adding a lot less than what the bottle says.
Yeah.
So that's one good way to reduce the amount you add. the bad thing is, though, that the constituent parts that the sorbet breaks down into are detectable in flavor at very low concentrations. So it, you know, it just doesn't take very much to. And another thing too, you got to consider that almost all of your melomels, whether you know it or not, if they sit in secondary long enough, there's a very, very high chance that they're going to go through a malolactic fermentation. And you may not even know it's happening.
Oh.
But they're going to go through it to some degree, unless you have really poured some sulfites in there hard and heavy. And most people don't do that, you know, coming right out of primary. So... And if you're getting malolactic fermentation, or if you've already had it and you add sorbate, you've ruined your batch when you put it in. So, I prefer to stay away from sorbate. I have found out that with plenty of time and a long time in secondary and get the thing clear, use a fining agent if you have to, and plenty of free SO2 that you just generally don't need it. But in the case of blending a dry and a sweet, if you don't do something to it, they're gonna take off.
You know, when these I've done a bunch of wine kits here, and you know, and I think Ryan alluded to this last week when we shed a little bit of light on them. They come with everything you need. I mean, the bentonite, the yeast, the grape juice, of course. They also come with this clearing, you know, this two-part liquid that you put in as well. And I've gotten away from using that because my wines usually sit in carboys for 8-9 months at a time before I even touch them. And they clear just fine without all that extra stuff in it. And to be honest, you know, the couple that I've done with and without, it doesn't affect the taste, I can guarantee you that. But if you let them sit, and I don't know how, you know, the bentonite, I mean, I'm not a scientist. I really have no idea what the bentonite does. I've read and heard that it's supposed to grab onto the big stuff and help settle the big stuff out to the bottom, whatever that means. And then I think Jeff was talking about, what is it, Jeff, the positive and negative to this two-part clearing stuff?
Right. So some of the, one of the fining agents in the two-part clearing agent, the Kielsol and the Chittosan, one of them is positively charged, one of them is negatively charged. The idea is kind of like magnets attract, you know, positive, negative. Yeah. And negatively charged ions will grab onto anything with a positive charge. And then 24 hours later, you follow it up with the opposite, and it grabs everything else. The idea is it just kind of makes everything glom together so it becomes nice and heavy and all sinks to the bottom. That way you can kind of rack right off of it.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned this. In another show, I think I mentioned that I've almost made this standard practice for everything I make now, is to degas it and use a fining agent as quickly as possible. As soon as fermentation is complete, it seems like it ages much faster, and it's ready for the bottle, ready to drink a lot faster. If you go ahead, get that CO2 out and clear it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and if I could interject here, as far as preventing future re-fermentation, another prudent step you can take if you don't want to go to the you know, the sorbites and the chemical stabilizers route, you can find a Bon Vino mini jet on Amazon for about $125 these days. The pads are not reusable, but you can filter down to half a micron, and that will get all of the yeast out of suspension. So there's literally nothing left to start re-fermentation to. And if you're really serious about doing that and leaving residual sugar in a product at having it bottled for a long period of time, that might be a really prudent move to make. That's something I've been considering myself here for a while.
You know,
I agree.
I've got a whole house filter that I believe does the same thing, because I've seen videos where guys have and it's just a container that you put these filters inside. It's got an in and an out that you can put your connections on and hook it up to a vacuum pump, vacuum system. And like when I transfer from one container to the next, I use my vacuum system. Like if I'm going to rack from one carboy to another carboy, like sometimes I do with my wine, when I'm in the final stages and I'm clearing it, I'm getting it all cleared out, I use a vacuum system. But this whole house filter, you can pick them up at Home Depot, hardware stores, whatever, Amazon. And they're like, I think I paid like $12 for it. And the filters are like $9. But you can get like half micron, you know, like 0.5 micron, 0.1 micron. And I've seen where guys use those too. And that might be a little bit cheaper way to go than spending $125 on a, you know, one of these, I've seen those pumps too, Jeff.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned that. I've actually been considering something similar to that as opposed to the Bonvino, just looking at my filtering options. Because if you go on to, I think it's morebeer.com, they have what they call a clarifier, and it's a stainless steel reusable filter that really appeals to me, because you're not like using up a whole bunch of pads, and essentially you're not wasting your part of your batch saturating that, but the filtration size is 5, 2, and 1 micron. It doesn't quite get down to half micron, but as far as getting the gross material out of suspension and making a nice polished wine, I think that would be a great option. At least from what I'm seeing, you know, you're paying a little bit more for those filters, but they are completely reusable. You just basically push the water back through the opposite direction, and it gets all the crud off of it. Yeah. So you can reuse it.
Yeah, I've never tried it, but I've seen lots of videos out there of guys set up that way, using a lot of winemaking, you know, guys that do this, like I do these kit wines at home and stuff, kind of get into that DIY stuff.
Yeah, the final word on that, though, if you want 100% certainty that you're not going to start, you know, and re-ferment in the bottle, you're going to have to add sulfites and sorbates. That's your only, the only other option is these people who pasteurize, and I'm 100% against that. I think that's absolutely ridiculous, because you're going to ruin the flavor of your mead. That's ridiculous. I don't know how it works with other beverages, but I would never even consider doing that.
I've heard of guys pasteurizing their beer and having bottles explode inside the pressure cooker.
Yeah, that's just something. I wouldn't even. That's not even on my list of considerations. So if you want 100% certainty, you're going to have to either filter, or you're going to have to add sulfites and sorbates. If you want 90% certainty, do it the way I said and let it get as clear as you possibly can and sulfite the hell out of it just before you bottle it and before you blend them. And, you know, I've been lucky so far. I haven't had any restart, but I've also heard of people who would put bottles back and cellar them, and everything was fine for 3, 4, 5 years, and then all of a sudden they decided to kick up and start pushing corks out. So you can never count them out.
Yeah, when I cork my bottles, my wine bottles, I don't put the little topper thing, the little shrink wrap topper thing on for at least a month. And I store the bottles upright at that point, and I keep watching the corks. And every once in a while, I'll see one cork that's just, you know, maybe an eighth of an inch rising up above the lip of the bottle. And, you know, I know that's going to be the first one that we open up. So,
yeah. And, you know, something else I've noticed, I think it was Ryan who sent us all an email asking us what kind of corks we use.
Yeah.
Is that you?
Yeah.
And I made the comment that I've gone completely to the Noma cork, the synthetic corks. But I have noticed that if you wet those, like I usually just drop them in a bowl of sulfite solution to sanitize them. If they're wet when they go in, sometimes just the pressure inside the bottle will push that cork back up a little bit because they're a little bit slicker than a natural cork. So what I started doing to solve that is I take a strainer and I put my corks in the strainer and I just put it over a bucket of sulfite and let the fumes sanitize them, because that's where your sanitizing power is with sulfites anyway, is in the fumes. So that's what I started doing. Yeah,
pays to have a mad scientist at the table, doesn't it?
I'm not totally mad. crazy, but I'm not mad.
I want to get back to, you know, a couple of shows ago or more, you know, we talked about oaking and that kind of thing. And I don't know how much time we spent on it, because I can't remember the show at all. That's because I'm old. I'm older than all of you. But I ran across something that I thought I'd throw out here on the table and find out if you guys have ever done this, or whether you think it's a good idea. But I don't remember what it might have been on. It might have been on a winemaking site, but I was reading a post where a guy, he's oaking his wine. Or no, by God, it was the beer site. A guy was making a bourbon beer, but he was using Jack Daniel's barbecue meant for like smokers. And he says it works fantastic because apparently these chips, and you can get them on Amazon. It's like $12 for like almost a 2 pound bag. These chips, they're all the same size, but they are, in fact, Jack Daniel's barrels that are no longer used and have been cut up and bagged. So I was wondering if you guys have ever heard that or have ever used it, Jeff.
You know, I've not specifically use them myself. I have heard of people using essentially the smoking wood, especially the premium stuff, as an aging unit or as an aging adjunct. I don't recall how well that worked out, but I know generally speaking, if you buy the barrel staves from homebrew stores, that's exactly what you're buying. You're getting an old barrel that somebody put through a table saw or a bandsaw to cut into little pieces. And you're getting essentially the remnants of whatever was aged in that barrel, whether it was bourbon or whiskey or port or whatever, along with some of the wood that never got touched during that aging process, just because it was so thick into the barrel stave itself. And they've essentially just cross-sectioned it. So I don't see why it wouldn't work, especially if they're, you know, if they're making it essentially food safe. I have to imagine that even a low heat smoker would be fairly sterile from even that amount of heat. But I would think that would work fine.
Well, these guys, this guy said that what he does, he takes a handful and, he steams them, for about 15 minutes and then soaks them in bourbon and then dumps them in his carboy. So, And that got me thinking, because when I jumped on Amazon, you know, they always have these suggested, the thing that you're looking at. So I'm scrolling through this, all this stuff, and there's like applewood, cherry wood, mesquite, hickory. So I'm thinking, wow, all these frickin' woods. I wonder what kind of beer, mead, this stuff would, what about dropping some cherry wood into a mead? What would that do, I wonder? I don't know if you guys have ever.
I've had a cherry wood aged beer that was interesting. I didn't pick up a lot of what I would consider the cherry wood flavor from it, but it was more of an experimental beer anyway, so...
What do you think, Aaron?
It sounds like an interesting concept to me, for sure. I think, I'm just thinking with my recent experience of getting into smoking meat and barbecuing, you really can impart some wildly different flavors with the type of wood that you use, okay. And how that would translate to a meat or a beer, I don't know, but I'm sure that there's just definitely room for experimentation here.
Well, and if you soak them in an alcohol, you're basically, I don't know, let's talk to the doctor. Is that a decent sanitizer? If you drop them in some vodka or I wouldn't use vodka. I'd use some kind of whiskey, bourbon or something,
I guess. I mean, people have been doing it for a long time, so
yeah.
I suppose it is. The alcohol doesn't really kill anything. It immobilizes it. So when you go to the doctor and
kinda,
you get an
injection. Kind of does that to people too, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. when you go to the doctor and you get an injection and they swab the area down with an alcohol pad, they're not killing any germs on there. They're immobilizing them, getting them out of the way. But I think it's a misconception that alcohol is a sterilizing agent, and it's not. It's a sanitizing agent. It is not a sterilizing agent. So, if you've steamed them and then you soak them, then I would imagine it would work, because I've done less than that with no problems. I've opened up a pack of oat cubes and dropped them straight into the fermenter or straight into the carboy and never had a problem. So, I've done that many, many times and
I've always
never
figured
had a problem.
I've always figured they come in these nice, foil, sealed packages. That they must be already be sanitized. So,
there again, what are you making? Because if you're making a 5 or 6%, 7% ABV session mead, then you've got a whole different set of rules to play by than you do with a 14% wine like mead. And with 14% working in your favor, I would say that you can get by with a lot more than you can on a session mead. So,
yeah. Well, and, with these wine kits, a lot of these red, like the deeper reds, the Merlots, Cabernets, Zinfandels, they come with wood chips. And, many times they tell you to put them in right up front and just drop them in. And then, don't do anything to them. You just take them out of the package and throw them in the fermenter.
Yep.
So.
But there again, like I said, most things with fruit, whether you know it or not, if it sits long enough in secondary without enough sulfites, chances are you're going to get a malolactic fermentation to some degree to take place. And. If it's one of those things that you sit back in secondary and forget about it for 6 or 8 months, it's almost a certainty that
it's going to happen.
Yeah.
So, adding wood to it, you know, that may just speed that process along. But, you know, then you've also got the issue that Brett is, known to live in oak and wood chips.
Yeah. Well, you're a meat and potatoes guy. Do you smoke meats, there at home? Barbecue?
Me?
Yeah. Do you do anything with,
you know, I do. You begged me.
Well,
to
all right.
Some.
So, you and Aaron, okay. I mean, these, you know, the wood that you guys use, I mean, would you use it? I mean, do you buy the prepackaged wood chip stuff like I'm talking about?
No, I grab a piece of hickory off the firewood stack.
That's good. Yeah, you're lucky hickory grows where. The only hickory you're gonna find around here is in a piece of furniture in an expensive store somewhere. So.
Yeah, when I smoke meat, I use either pecan or hickory, and you know, I've got some oak in the stack that I use. It's red oak that you might use in the fireplace, but
yeah.
Smoking meat, no, I use hickory or pecan, and there's really nothing in that I would want to put in a mead. And you know that I've done a little woodworking as a hobby.
Sure.
On the side also, and I've worked with a lot of cherry wood, and I can tell you just by working with it, cutting it, sanding it, and everything, I don't really get anything in the aroma of cherry wood that I would want in a mead either. So but that's just me.
Well, I mean, I think there's probably some woods out there. I mean, you know, there's got to be a reason why they chose oak to make barrels out of instead of pine.
And white oak at that, not red oak. Very, very huge difference between those two. And if you ever run a piece through the table saw and you smell it, you can tell right away that the white oak has a certain, you know, it almost has a maple characteristic. It has a certain sweetness to it.
Yeah, I was going to say a sweet, yeah.
Where the red oak is just a really pungent, I don't know, it's a real coarse smell, and it's not something you would want in a mead, I don't think.
Ryan, are you a smoker, or do you prefer to run down to the supermarket and pick up your smoke flavored stuff?
You know, I do not have a smoker right now. I got everything on a big Weber grill that I have. But you know, I got a buddy who's got a smoker, and I've done a lot of things over there with him. You know, everything from fish to beef to lamb, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I've been kicking around, there's a meadery, I'm going to forget which one, that smokes cherries. And then after they smoke the cherries, you know, they put those in their mead.
Smoke cherries.
And I thought that was pretty cool that they smoked the cherries and did that. And then I thought, you know, and stay with me for a minute on this one, but what if you had your honey, and whether you had some sort of container that had a lot of surface area, you know, exposed, and you were able to expose the honey to a little bit of smoke, you know, before fermenting it?
Interesting.
You know, I've actually thought about that, and I believe it would work. I think it might be interesting to do that. I tell you what I did. I made this huge mess one day. I wanted to try a cherry chipotle mead, and I was going to put a couple of chipotles in secondary. Now, chipotle is nothing but a smoked, dried jalapeno.
Right.
you can't find them where I live unless they're in some sort of sauce. You can't just buy a plain smoked jalapeno or chipotle pepper. They're always canned and they're mixed with some kind of sauce or something. So I said, you know, I'll just make my own. So I go out to my barbecue smoker and I put a piece of aluminum foil down and lay my peppers on it. And I was going to let them smoke all day long, just dry real slowly. I didn't take into account the fact that I've got all this grease and stuff from smoking pork in there. So when I took the peppers out, they're just dripping with grease that was in the smoke. And I said, you know, what the hell? I had already made up this 1 gallon batch of cherry Melomel, and I had no other use for it. So I said, you know, what the hell? I'm going to throw this pepper in anyway. And it tasted like barbecued swill when it got finished. And I decided that was not the way to go. So if I'm going to smoke peppers, I'm going to have to get a good clean grill to do it with.
I like the idea of the smoked honey, but we're talking cold smoke, right, Ryan? I mean,
yeah,
because you wouldn't want to crank the heat up. It's not going to do the honey any good, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I was thinking cold smoke. You know what I mean? I wouldn't layer smoke on smoke. So, for example, like I was saying, if you wanted to smoke some fruit, I wouldn't use a smoked honey. But I'd either use the smoked fruit or the smoked honey. But yeah, I would try to cold smoke that honey. I mean, if you do it hot, you essentially are creating a new way to, you know, start yourself on a bouchée, you know, by, you're probably going to do some caramelizing.
Well, yeah. I'm thinking more like cold smoke, to kind of retain the qualities of the honey a little better. The container, I mean, gosh, what about putting like, a gallon of honey in some kind of a oak container and smoking it, like something that's had some bourbon? What if you could char your own little half barrel? And anyway, I'm going off on a deep,
I'm kind of interested in something similar to that. You said putting it in an oak container. I've been interested in fermenting in an oak barrel, doing the actual fermentation in an oak vessel.
Yeah.
And that sort of came about through this whole Braggot deal. When I was looking into different beer styles, I found that a lot of the wee heavies, the Scottish wee heavies that we talked about, are fermented in an oak, in an oak vat, and basically just open fermented. So,
yeah,
that got me wondering, because they don't age it in oak, but they ferment it in oak. So I'm thinking, well, what's that do? You know, it's something I've never looked into. So.
Yeah, one of the home brew stores near me sells oak barrels, and they're already pre-charred. You bring them home, you got to fill them full of water a couple of times, and so the wood swells up and seals. I'm kind of afraid to bring one home because I really don't want one to leak all over the place here in the house. But I would love to age a mead or a wine or even a beer, like one of these bourbon barrel beers, the Braggots in an oak barrel. But there's a whole science. There's a reason why oak wine barrels are the size they are, and it has everything to do with surface contact area with the liquid. Same thing with bourbon barrels. And I don't fully understand that. And the guys at the home brew shop, the one with the, the owner owns a winery up the coast from us. Was talking to him one day about it, and it's a kind of a delicate thing, really. And you really got to pay attention to what you're doing with these oak barrels. So I don't think I'm ready to try that yet. Have any of you guys, Jeff or Ryan, Aaron, you guys done anything in an oak barrel at all?
I have not done anything in a barrel. Everything I've done now has either been chips or staves or spirals or, you know, triangles are probably next. But, you know, I'm not going to think. I've a couple of times I've seen, you know, there's a lot of distilleries around me and even online, a couple of times I've seen, you know, these used bourbon barrels advertised.
Right.
You know, and there's been a big tug at me, you know, a couple of times to say, I'm just going to buy that 15-gallon, you know, bourbon barrel. And I'm going to fill it up with 15 gallons of traditional and just let it sit for a year. And, you know, and then I have, you know, or whatever. And then I have 15 gallons of, you know, bourbon barrel aged. And then I think about it and I think about it and I think about it and I go, is there really any difference other than the majesty of me doing that versus, you know, buying some bourbon staves and at, you know, 1/20th of the cost and making a reasonable, you know, 3 or 5 gallon batch of it.
Yeah.
I think we've all exactly. thought about it just out of our, you know, our curiosity, the novelty of doing it. But in all honesty, I'm not a big enough fan of oak to really get that deep into it.
Yeah. Jeff, you done anything like that at all? Or?
No, but much like Ryan, I fantasized about it. I think the practicality has won out over the aspiration of it. And really, you know, like Ryan touched on, you get mostly the same effect from staves or beans without all the hassle of it.
Yeah.
And I, more than anything, I just would want the bragging rights of, you know, coming over or having my friends come over and say, hey, you see that barrel? That's full of mead.
Yeah.
How cool is that, guys? Right?
Yeah, you know.
It's just a novelty. It's a curiosity, and it's a novelty, and you always have in your mind that somehow there's something magic that happens, but I don't think it is.
I'm going to have to look. I believe it may have been, it might be on YouTube, but I'll have to look. There's a guy. This was in a news article that I read online, and who runs a winery out of his 800 square foot apartment. Now he's got wine barrels stacked up to the ceiling, and he runs this whole frickin' winery out of his apartment. Did you see that article?
I saw an article, not the article itself. I saw it was a video interview with the guy.
Yeah.
He has a little wine club where he has tastings like every few months, and
people
just pay to join his little club, and they get a bottle to take home or something at the end of the tasting. Friggin' brilliant!
The furniture in his apartment is all his wine stuff, these barrels and stuff. I mean, it's pretty cool. Anyway, we pretty much run the gamut tonight, guys, at the end of our time. We're going to take a couple of weeks off and do some, I'm sure we'll be in touch with each other, come up with some more ideas, some people to talk to. One shout out that I wanted to throw out here before I forget, Daniel Brown. He's an avid listener of the show. He heard the show. We were talking about the Braggots and my bourbon barrel project and how I was going to use the Buffalo Trace Eagle Rare in one of my projects. And so apparently he either lives close or vacationed or something. Anyway, went to the Buffalo Trace Distillery and sent me about, oh gosh, must be about 14 or 15 pictures. I'm going to put some of them up on the website. from the Buffalo Trace Distillery there. Just, man, an awesome looking place there in Kentucky. But much appreciated that, Daniel. Thanks a million. And guys, what do you say we come back in a couple of weeks and do this again? Yeah?
Sounds like a plan.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Right on.
Good to me.
All right. Hey, thanks for listening. We'll see everybody in a couple of weeks.